Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, a series of conversations on sports and culture with various fans, friends, and media personalities. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting viewmyseats.com. Thanks for listening. My guest today, Mary Pilon, is the author of the best-selling book, The Monopolists, and has also been reporting on the recent corruption charges levied against FIFA.
Let's get right to it. There's perhaps nobody better to ask this question to, but is Sepp Blatter nothing more than a modern-day Mr. Monopoly?
I hadn't actually thought of it quite exactly in those terms, but, you know, it sounds like there might be, if the DOJ is right, there might be a few Mr. Monopolies in the mix here at FIFA. I mean,
right.
That's what's so striking about it in terms of sports scandals to me is that, you know, I think in sports you're used to having kind of the one bad apple story. So, you know, Adrian Peterson or Tom Brady more recently, or, you know, Lance Armstrong or whatever the nature of the, you know, perceived crime with like quote marks around it. But this is like the entire organization is supposedly, corrupt. So, that's what I think, I find it so fast. Excuse me. That's what I find so fascinating about it.
Yeah. It's like a hydra with many heads, right? It you cut off one head and 10 more grow back. It does seem as if the tentacles of this, investigation and this corruption, we've probably only scratched the surface, and I have so many questions. I think most fans of sports have more questions than they do answers, but I think we can all agree that Sepp Blatter resigning this week is hopefully a step in the right direction, although they're not close to really naming a successor, are they?
No, and you know who that's going to be is going to be almost like Shakespearean in terms of the power grab. And one of the things I've been talking – I mean, well, first of all, Sepp Blatter is not off the hook legally, right? I mean – there's quite a range of news outlets that are reporting that, you know, he's in the crosshairs, the DOJ as well. And given how in-depth that complaint is, it would make sense that they, you know, as more people come forward, they would get more information on him. He's obviously a big fish. So he's definitely, you know, I think walking around with a target on his back. But in terms of who takes that job, first of all, I doubt it'll be American. You know, somebody, I can't remember who it was, somebody was writing about like, Mitt Romney should go in because, you know, he cleaned up the Salt Lake City games and he's so good at managing. And I thought, well, first of all, there's qualifications. Like, it would be a little bit more involved with, you know, soccer specifically. But I doubt an American, you know, because the DOJ will get it. And that includes even Caitlyn Jenner, who I think could solve all of this, right? Take the most beloved figure in sports and, you know, have them replace this organization that's reviled. But one of the things that I'm very curious about and how this shakes out is a lot of the things that happened with Sepp Blatter and, you know, his kind of inner circle are structural. So things like the FIFA's voting system and how, you know, if you're a tiny country versus, you know, United States, you have as much say at the table. So a lot of these things allowed the infrastructure of that organization, which again was something Blatter was obviously involved with for years and years and years. Those structural issues still remain. So whether they get like a real reformer in there who's going to kind of rip it up a bit, or somebody who's going to just kind of, you know, be following in his footsteps, but maybe not as an extreme in terms of, you know, holding on to power and ignoring things like term limits, you know, I still think there's a ton of work to be done.
Mary, do you think the reason why this is happening in 2015 and not, you know, 15 years ago,
right,
is because countries didn't really want the depths of the corruption to be fully exposed? Because, you know, from what I understand, it looks like a lot of different entities had their hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. And I think there are – I don't know if countries or their sporting committees are concerned about the revelations that are going to come out in this investigation. But do you think that's one of the reasons why it took so long to see a change here?
Well, the why now piece is fascinating. And, you know, for Americans, it's funny because a lot of the FIFA corruption is covered really extensively elsewhere in the world, you know, particularly in Europe. So the idea of this isn't exactly new. I think what tipped the DOJ over is having a whistleblower, right? I mean, Chuck Blazer coming forward, I think, was a huge catalyst in them being able to push forward this case and really nail down some of these rumors and claims that people had heard for years and years. But, you know, you mentioned the cookie jar, which I think is a really important point, which is that the cookie jar itself has gotten enormous in the last few years. And I think that broadcast money and sponsors have changed a lot. I mean, college sports, obviously, the NFL. But to me, I mean, all stories are kind of business stories, and this one is no different. And if you look at the amount of money that has gone into soccer, you know, I think this is a tale as old as time. When the cookie jar is bigger and bigger, you're going to have more people, you know, grabbing for it. And one of the stories that I wrote this week for The New Yorker took a look at that, and that even if you're an American who has no interest in soccer, the companies that are fueling FIFA, which is a marketer's dream, right? It's the most popular sport in the world. If you look at the World Cup last year and how it really impacted people on television, but also social media. I mean, the companies that are writing checks to FIFA are these, they're companies you and I all know, you know, and your listeners, you know, it's McDonald's, it's Visa, it's Nike. And they could have, in theory, pulled their money and said, this company, you know, this organization has a huge track record of corruption. We don't want to do business with them, you know, but nobody's yanking their checks, which I find really telling. So, you know, pre-bladder stepping down, on paper, you have the exact same people writing the checks and you have the exact same guy running the show until very, very recently. So, you know, the cynic, excuse me, the cynic in me thinks not a lot has really changed. So, you know, it's crazy to me if you step back and think that you have all these companies that are so involved and that, you know, with the NFL and domestic violence, for example, you really saw an uprising from particularly female football fans, which has been a growing base, saying, you know, we're not going to support this, and companies that sponsored the NFL feeling the heat. And I'm surprised that we're not really seeing that with FIFA, that people aren't picking up Big Macs or, you know, Nike Freeze and saying, oh, this group is sponsoring one of the most corrupt organizations in sports. But so it's been really interesting to see that shake out. And I think that picture has changed in the last 5 or 10 years for sure.
Yeah, and I wonder why that is. Do you think that's because, at least speaking from the perspective, the American perspective, that's because we, until recently, we as Americans didn't perhaps know as much about the issues as we should have, and that's why we're not sour on the companies that are sponsoring FIFA? Or do you think that these companies just see the bottom line, and they look at the bottom line and they say to themselves, gosh, you know, there's just still so much money to be made at being a part of this global game that even this bad press we're receiving now, it doesn't really make us want to step back and stop ending our business relationship with FIFA.
Right. Well, I think it's both. But the latter, I think, is a huge piece. And that then it gets back into tied into monopolies, dare we say. FIFA has a monopoly on soccer. So if you're a huge multinational company and you want to reach this huge audience, there's one show in town, and that's FIFA. So as opposed to, say, if you're sponsoring an individual athlete and they mess up, you can say, okay, well, there's plenty of great football players, plenty of great basketball players who are upstanding people that, you know, a sponsor could go. There's competition in the marketplace for those sponsorship dollars. Any athlete who's trying to make a go of it will tell you that, too. But with soccer, and you also see this with like the Olympics, you know, when you look back at Sochi and the, Russian laws, you know, against LGBT, the LGBT population, a lot of sponsors there came under heat. But again, they're the Olympic sponsor, you know, that they have a lock on, the Olympics, the IOC does. So it's, it gets to kind of this antitrust issue. So I think if you're a company, and Richard Branson basically called on these sponsors to pull anyway, but I think a lot of folks are saying this is just too good of an opportunity to step away from right away. So, you know, whether that's right or wrong, I think is this fascinating ethical dilemma, and the one that I was trying to explore in the New Yorker story, because we just haven't really had something like this where, again, it's not just like there's one bad actor in FIFA. I mean, the DOJ is indicting a lot of people. So to say you're a sponsor that doesn't, I wasn't aware of this or wasn't like concerned about it. I mean, it just, I don't know how long that's going to hold up.
And I've tried to wrap my mind around what exactly FIFA does. I know they're a governing body. I know they're in charge of organizing these soccer events around the world, but you know, I'm not entirely sure what FIFA's role is. I get how powerful they are, but their role exactly in controlling, because you mentioned early on that they're the only show in town, and that if people want these games like they do around the world, then they have to go to FIFA. And FIFA makes me think, to relate it to something that we're more familiar with here in the United States. FIFA's corruption reminds me a lot, different issues, but it's kind of like the NCAA in the sense that it's almost this, this sounds, might not sound right, but it's almost like this necessary evil where there's this inherent corruption that goes into these all-powerful governing bodies. And if you got rid of the NCAA, like, you know, it's been suggested, or you change some of their rules, somebody else would step in. And it seems like that new monopoly that would come in would just provide a different kind of corruption. So I'm not overly optimistic that FIFA's the problem as much as the need to have some kind of overseer as the real problem.
Well, and you have this in sports. I think you're picking up on something that's important, which is that, you know, if you look at the NFL, right? I mean, that's the product of two leagues merging in the 1960s. There used to be two football leagues, and none of this mattered, really. I mean, the idea of having one organization that governed one sport, none of this, or one organization that governed all college sports, what changed was the money. And once it happens, you know, it's just true. Money changes everything, right? So I think that happened in FIFA and in college sports and with football and with all these other organizations. So many of which are still operating as nonprofits, which has now come under fire. So I think that the framework, and you see this in government, you see this in a lot of situations where the framework is older than the reality. So you have all this money coming. I mean, FIFA is a multi-billion dollar powerhouse. So the idea that they're claiming that soccer is a public good and it's a charity, you know, it seems like silly to anybody who's ever watched a game, right?
Right.
But back in the day, you know, that was probably more true. So I think that that's something that when something really blows up like this, or, you know, I guess it was a year or so ago, maybe longer, when Roger Goodell's compensation came out, or every now and then you'll have something that kind of makes people say, whoa. And then quietly amidst the draft, the NFL kind of snuck in this news that they were relinquishing their nonprofit status, which was fascinating, but I think also very much under political pressure from Washington. So even they're stepping back, and the MLB has been private for a while. So I do think you're seeing some interesting, it's pretty wonky too. I think most fans want to watch great soccer. They want to watch great football. They want to watch, you know, March Madness. So this stuff is very off court and it gets very geeky, but I think it has a huge impact on society and people who aren't sports fans, and as well as those, of course, who are. And when you talk to athletes, these things come up over and over and over again because it really dramatically impacts their bottom line and their, you know, passion for the game and being able to compete. So it's kind of under the category of sometimes boring but important. And so what's exciting about FIFA, too, is like now people care. I mean, people are talking about it in a way that, at least in the States, I don't think that they really were quite as fully, you know, at least not in my memory.
So what happens with Qatar? Because this is an issue which, you know, we've heard about before this scandal broke, as far as the working conditions and these migrant workers who are, you know, forced to stay in the country and are working in such horrific conditions, and, you know, how they got the World Cup, the 2022 World Cup in the first place is just the kind of the case, the poster for the corruption of FIFA. Do you think it's reasonable to expect that the 2022 World Cup is moved to somewhere else in the world, like the United States or in England, perhaps? Or are we just still looking at people have also said, hey, what about Russia in 2018? I think that's out of the question. But 2022 Qatar, do you think that's going to happen now, or what do you expect?
I think at this point, anything's possible. And the Qatar bid in particular, I mean, look, like Russia, since the bid, you know, has hosted an Olympics that was, you know, I was at, and I was surprised, pleasantly surprised at how safe it was. I was really, I mean, given the politics at the time, the climate, just expecting the worst. And thankfully, you know, that didn't happen. It was a safe and sound games. So they actually have some, you know, how I think in hosting these major international events. And also, of course, it's just sooner. But the Qatar case, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that gets really reevaluated. But again, it goes back to the FIFA governance structure, that the kind of people making these decisions and the way those decisions are being made, hasn't really changed much. So for Qatar to get overruled would take a voting bloc and political momentum within FIFA that we don't know if that's there quite yet. Because, you know, you can remove some of these people, but, I mean, the world of FIFA is small and cloistered, and there's a lot of people who have financial incentives in that, in it being in Qatar. I mean, you know, the average temperature there alone would make me wonder if I would, you know, if I was an athlete, if I would want to be there.
Haven't they already moved it to the winter?
December, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious to think about, you know, here in New York, going to your favorite soccer bar and watching World Cup in December when the snow's falling. But
ultimately we'll do it, which is probably why these sponsors know that they can stay with FIFA, because we're going to watch whenever it is, right? I mean, that's ultimately, it's sad to say, but it's ultimately why people stay in business with FIFA, because they know regardless of when the World Cup takes place and where it takes place, that people are still going to watch, not just in this country, but obviously around the world.
Absolutely. And I think that's the fascinating part about writing about sports. And I remember thinking about this during the World Cup last year, that people still watch. I mean, that's the pull of soccer. That's the pull of sports, is that it's almost like, well, it is a religion. You know, that's that language comes up more in soccer than I think any other sport. And I don't see soccer fans in 2022, if it's in Qatar, protesting. Maybe they will. And especially if new information comes forward that, I mean, people have died. Like, that's what seems crazy to me about that in particular, is that the level of, you know, anxiety and things that have happened already, and the games are years away, is pretty dramatic. And yet I think that people just love soccer. So it's this fascinating dance everybody's doing right now, right? Between trying to do the right thing and then trying to clean up this, you know, ugly mess, but also human nature, right? So we'll see. But I do think it's definitely on the table, but whether that actually gets any momentum behind it, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
And if not Caitlyn Jenner for FIFA president, how about John Oliver? How about John Oliver?
Oh, John Oliver is definitely, in the mix. And, you know, I rewatched the one he did last year during the World Cup, and of course the one he did more recently. It's pretty, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, a foreigner is doing all the best US-based soccer coverage right now.
No, we should not be surprised. But let me shift gears slightly to there are a couple stories that I know you're following that actually involve one of FIFA's main corporate sponsors, and that is Nike. Mm-hmm. I think it was David Epstein who just wrote a piece recently about this supposedly, you're going to be able to tell it better than I, but it seems as if Nike, or there's a coach involved with one of Nike's running programs, that is being accused of, was it 2012, the Olympics in London, of using performance enhancers to get athletes ready for the 2012 London Olympics? Do I have that somewhat right?
Right. So Alberto Salazar, he's not just so the Nike running project, just to back up a little bit, was this group that was started. There was kind of this lull in American distance running in particular. So, you know, in the 70s, and I just wrote a big piece for Grantland about Steve Prefontaine, who died in this car accident in Eugene, Oregon, my hometown, in 1975. And his death, he's kind of like the James Dean of running. And, you know, him and Frank Shorter and a lot of these runners in the 70s were considered to be kind of part of the American running boom. And from, you know, Steve Prefontaine's legacy, we get Nike. So Salazar himself is this fascinating character, because he's kind of part of that running boom. I mean, he was an incredibly talented runner, run the New York Marathon, is kind of an icon in the sport. So the Nike Oregon Running Project starts with the goal of trying to produce and bring back some of the magic to the sport of track. And it starts in, and of course it's, you know, as the name implies, headquartered in Oregon, where now Nike is this, you know, massive sports empire. So for somebody to accuse Salazar isn't just like saying some coach that was at the Olympics. It's accusing somebody who's considered to be one of the best coaches in the world, and athletes himself. So, you know, it's fascinating. And I think that Epstein, I'm a big fan of his work. I think he's a great journalist. I think that ProPublica is great, and I find him to be super credible. But, you know, some of the stuff the details in the story are fascinating, but I think the most damning piece of it is the comments from Kara and Adam Gauscher. So Kara Gauscher trained with Salazar for years and has since left. She's now in Colorado. And her husband also is a Nike Oregon Project athlete. And Kara represented the U.S. At the London Marathon, in the marathon at the London Olympics in 2012, which is when I covered her. And some of the things she said weren't even really related to doping, but this idea of weight and needing to lose weight. And for her to go on the record with stuff against Salazar that was that strong was really striking to me. The world of track and field, not just in the U.S., but internationally, has been so plagued by doping. Like Tyson Gay and Justin Gatlin. I mean, there's just like so many names now. And then Rita Jeptu at the Chicago Marathon, who I wrote about. So the fact that this is prevalent in sport isn't news. Whether WADA or USADA or anybody really digs in with Salazar and some of these athletes, we'll see. But the other thing we've learned from the Armstrong case is that if you're an elite athlete and you have a lot of money, it's pretty easy to get around drug tests. It's pretty easy to cheat and get a pretty sophisticated cocktail. So whenever, and this came up in Armstrong's case, but it comes up constantly in doping stories, like, oh, I passed on my drug test. It's like, well, yeah, but like, you know, you or I could Google how to get out of a drug test and we could probably figure it out. So there's this constant game of cat and mouse between drug testers and coaches and athletes. So it's really complicated. And I think that Epstein really got in the weeds with it. And of course, Salazar's pushed back on it, which I'm not surprised by, but...
Yeah, do you think that the difference here is that it's kind of all under Nike's banner? I mean, I don't expect Nike, the institution, to be brought down just because of its popularity. But do you think what makes this somewhat sexier is the idea that all this was taking place in a Nike facility? Do you think that's why this story could have some teeth to it?
I think there's something to it. I think it's more that just not just the Nike piece, but the Salazar piece, that he's an iconic coach and such an iconic personality. And that it involves athletes who won medals and are world champions and, you know, have incredible. So it involves this circle of people that I think draw a lot of attention. Now, Nike, of course, has a lot of money at stake. And, you know, Nike's mandate is pretty clear, which is win, right? I mean, that's what but I think that the pressure from sponsors to win is something that exists in a lot of sports and especially in track. So I do think that the Nike piece is part of it, but I also think that if you look at other athletes who've fallen, whether that's for doping or other reasons, the Nike factor has always been there. So like Tiger Woods, Lance Armstrong. So I think that whether that's, you know, you're actually training on our facility or we're just sponsoring you to train somewhere else, it speaks to an athlete's profile that they'd be sponsored by, you know, kind of the big show in town. So I do think that's part of it. But I think that if it was, you know, the Nike Oregon Project and maybe an athlete or coach that was fledgling and didn't have the results that they were getting right now, especially after, which is such a remarkable turnaround for them in the medal count, particularly for the men, that's part of what I think makes it really striking.
And also, the only difference is that Tiger Woods wasn't getting into trouble at Las Vegas casino sponsored by Nike. As far as I know. He might have been wearing the swoosh polos, but...
Right, and it's this fascinating, circumstance I think a lot of sponsors are in now, is this idea of how do you know if anybody is clean, how do you not? But I think that people, I mean, doping is this fascinating. I remember when I started writing about sports thinking, oh, I don't want to write about doping at all because everybody writes about it. But then you soon learn you can't not write about it because it comes up over and over and over again in whatever sport. I mean, I wrote about a curling doping bust leading up to Sochi. I mean, it's just, it's everywhere. And it's, but I think if you're not an athlete, I mean, if you or I could take something to make us better at our jobs, we knew everybody else around us was taking it, or we assumed we did, and we thought we wouldn't get caught. Like, and not only would we be better at our jobs, we'd be rich and famous. Like, I think, like, we would probably do it. You know?
Yeah. just out of curiosity, but did the curler test positive for light beer?
No. It was steroids. I'd have to double check, but it was like steroids. Like it was classic, you know, speed. Yeah, no, I think you're allowed. I'd have to check the WADA list. I don't think you're allowed to have pot, but I think you can have alcohol. People with beer, it's fine.
Okay, as long as beer is not on the banned substance list. Just two quick questions here, and I know you got to go, but I saw that you wrote about Prefontaine, Steve Prefontaine for Grantland, and it was a great piece, long piece, and you weren't making this argument, but it would be really interesting to make this argument, which is, you know, who's been more important to the swoosh, the Nike brand, a guy like Prefontaine or somebody more visible like Michael Jordan?
Oh, what a great question. I think that what's fascinating about those two examples is to me they're like act one and act two, right?
So that's great. I think that's the right way to put it.
Prefontaine is very much part of their origin story and the rebelliousness of it and, you know, kind of the grassrootsy part. But then if you look at the point that Jordan steps in, Nike isn't the same company that was started in Oregon in the 70s. And it's this massive – and so I think that Jordan kind of took the idea of the athlete brand and just shot it outward. So I think that Jordan – you know, I think Prefontaine's legacy, which obviously still lives on in these huge ways, I think that if you're telling the Nike story, that's the first part. But Jordan, like, kind of picks up where that left off in a pretty remarkable way. And I was just thinking about this, like, the shoe wars and – all of that. And I think of that much more as a Jordan thing. But I don't think anybody, what's fascinating about looking at the Prefontaine, you know, his life and when he died and kind of that early inner circle of folks who are around with kind of the birth of Nike is that it's actually kind of like Monopoly. Like nobody knew what they were sitting on. Nobody had any idea that it was going to explode into this huge thing. And, you know, that athletes and how they were marketed and all this was going to become so big. So I do think that they're definitely related, but they're almost kind of like these kindred spirits in different ways.
Yeah. It's almost like apples to oranges. You don't want to compare. You want to hold them both in the anthology, though.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting when you think about today and how people buy things and what makes them, you know, drawn to something, you know, who the next giant person is going to be, the next big marketing thing. Or like in the music industry, I remember when Michael Jackson died, there was a lot of talk about how there will never be a pop star like Michael Jackson because people just don't buy albums the same way. They don't watch music videos the same way. Everything's so fractured. Or it's harder to become a pop star like that. And I wonder if sports, if that's true, like, is it harder to have one person be so dominant because now the world is so broad in terms of sports and you have and I think it's a good thing. Like, you have so many people to choose from. Like, I don't know if a Serena Williams would have been as big of a marketing powerhouse 30 years ago as she is today. I don't know if, you know, I'm trying to think of some other examples. But you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I do.
Yeah. So, like, Jordan, would a Michael Jordan be possible the same way? I mean, Kobe, you know, like, they're all these other names, LeBron.
Yeah. I'd go the other way. I'd say, you know, I'd say that they'd be bigger.
Oh, really?
The Jordan, I don't think his brand would be diluted now if he were just starting now as opposed to when he did. I mean, we're talking about just a seminal talent and someone who captured the imagination of fans and marketers and everyone. And now that you increase that exposure, I think it's tough to imagine a brand like Jordan being more popular if it started today than when it did. But I look at it maybe differently as that exposure would help. Quickly, I know you got to go, but I had to ask, since you wrote a great book, The Monopolists, about the foundations of the board game that we all thought we knew and love, I have to ask you, since we were all kids, and when we were kids, we all had a favorite color that we had to have on the board. Mine was green. I wanted the green right before Boardwalk and Park Place. I wanted the three greens. I just figured that more people landed on those and they were still pricey enough, so it was good real estate. What about you, Mary?
Let me see. Well, I think the oranges. I think the best strip is that strip from jail to free parking because more people land on it.
Okay.
So that's usually what I go for. And the last few times I've played, that's how I've won the game. So those are the best because the ROI, the return on investment for building there is fantastic, and it just gets landed on more. So I have, like, very little interest in the greens or the blues, to be honest. But
too pricey for you.
Yeah.
Well, I feel, you know, I have young kids, and I feel it's part of my responsibility as being a parent to those young kids is making sure that they understand the competitive nature of Monopoly. I don't want them to be monopolists, but I'd love for them to enjoy the board game. Mary, thank you so much for taking the time to talk FIFA, Nike, all good stuff, and hopefully we can chat again in the future.
Of course. Thanks so much.